Do if you ever want. Okay, so here we are again. IVS Oral History Project. Today is the 22nd of June, I hope.
Is it the 23rd?
I don't know.
I don't have my watch on.
Let's take a look at the times.
Oh.
Yeah, let's see. 23rd. Oh, okay. 23rd. Okay. We both scrambled away from the tape, looking at the newspaper, because we don't even know what day it is. Anyway, it's Sunday, June 23rd. And I'm here with John Summer in his home. It's nice and early in the morning. Well, no, it isn't, but it is for me.
It's been light for 6 hours.
Is it? Yes, it probably has. Anyway. Vietnam is the country of service, 63 to 67, you have for the times, and then we'll get more into the breakdown and stuff like that. Okay, that's the official stuff of who I am, who I'm talking to, where we are, and when. First question is, so how did you like Africa? I'm sorry. That's an inside joke. No, the first question deals with stuff that's not on the form. And basically the form, because it's only 4 pages, doesn't have very much room to go into a lot of things. And one thing that we're interested in is people's lives in terms of pre-IVS. So things like when you were born, where you grew up, what your parents did, schooling, church, other extracurricular activities, anything that you think is important for you, and it varies from person to person, that got you to the point where you joined IVS. You know, that we'd like to know as a basic, okay, basic thing. That's a very free form kind of question. So it's just as vague as the form, you know, but it's tailored so that you can make it up yourself. So,
born in 1941,
okay,
shortly before Pearl Harbor.
okay.
I don't think there was a cause and effect.
Yeah. Okay.
The
other things I think might have had a bigger sway.
Grew up in those New York suburbs in northern New Jersey, fairly boring, I guess, by most standards. Certainly compared with what came later. And.
But so was everyone's life.
Probably.
Yeah.
My father was in, for most of the time that I was growing up, was in the importing business with respect to the papermaking machine. Also seemed to me fairly boring.
Mm.
And it was the boring 50s for the most part when I grew up. So I'm not sure that, unless you characterize my reason for wanting to go with IVS in Vietnam was a reaction to get some excitement in a boring period of history and life. Or a suburban area, maybe there's something to that, maybe there isn't, I don't know.
Well, why was James Dean popular?
I think he was popular while I was in Vietnam.
I
missed him anyway. Anyway, I'm not sure quite what more I can say about that. I went to college at Wesleyan in Middletown, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Had gone to a very small high school. It was a demonstration high school for the local teacher's college, which is now Montclair State College.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And has become quite big.
Mm-hmm.
The high school later went out of existence. So I'm not sure that that had any influence.
Cause and effect there?
Right. Now I was thinking more of the small high school class. Was a very pretty close-knit group of people.
Okay.
So probably would not be true in a big high school.
Mm-hmm.
And Wesleyan was a small college, and all male, which was, with hindsight, probably a mistake, not to go to a co-ed school, but of course, the majority of colleges, I think, at least the ones I would have been looking at, were single sex in those days. The impulse to go to IVS and to Vietnam was really based on my assumption the minute I heard about the Peace Corps being founded that I wanted to go into the Peace Corps. I was a typical member, I guess, of the Kennedy generation. I gone down with some friends by car to his inauguration. I could have kept you up last night showing you my home movies of Kennedy's inauguration.
Oh, I would have wanted. I think I might have stayed away.
It was awfully cold, so they're kind of shaky. holding the camera was difficult. But so I was clearly, Miss Sergeant Shriver came to Wesleyan while I was there, and I think that left something of an impact.
Mm-hmm.
I'd always liked to travel. That's probably the deeper root of the motivation. And my father had taken us to Europe as children on one of his business trips at one point, and that was a fairly seminal experience, I guess. So
sure.
Travel and was always a big thing for me.
Yeah.
And when it came to translating my idealism and the Peace Corps idea and everything, and the travel influence, my tendency was to want to go to the furthest away place possible, assuming that would be the most interesting and the most exotic. So
mm-hmm.
I hit on Southeast Asia as seeming
yeah.
to fit that description. I guess, I don't know if there was any... Oh, yes, in college I was very influenced by India and Indonesia because we had an ethnomusicology program, and I got very much into Indian and Indonesian music. So I wasn't, for some reason, so interested in going to India, but Indonesia, Southeast Asia, I was.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, to cut a long story reasonably, manageably short, I applied to Peace Corps and thought that, as I had done with college, I should apply to a couple of others just to make sure I get into one or the other.
Yeah.
So applied to the American Friends Service Committee
mm-hmm.
and to IBS simultaneously. AFSC brought me down to Philadelphia for interviews, but didn't tell me until after they had bothered to bring me down that they didn't have anything open in Southeast Asia, or anything at all, in fact.
Really?
And, well, they only had four countries, I think, at that particular point.
Then why
point.
Did they waste their time and yours?
I don't know.
God.
It was an interesting experience, the interview,
mm-hmm.
For reasons we can come back to at some point. But, well, mainly because they had everyone go through a psychiatric, an interview with a psychiatrist, I should say,
mm-hmm.
or a psychologist, I'm not sure which he was.
Yeah.
Which I thought was actually a very smart idea. Anyway, the Peace Corps just didn't answer, and IBS answered with quite admirable promptness. And I waited around for a while to see if Peace Corps would answer, and they
mm-hmm.
didn't. And IBS had offered Vietnam. I thought they were quite reckless to offer it without an interview or anything else. And one motivation for thinking maybe I should go ahead and not wait for Peace Corps anymore was because I could use my French in Vietnam. So that seemed to make some sense, and it was Southeast Asia, so I went with the bird in hand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at that point, to be an English teacher. And 2 weeks later, Peace Corps answered. In fact, they phoned me because they were concerned about the delay themselves, apparently, and they offered me Thailand, which actually, along with Indonesia or Nepal, was really where I would have liked to go. Nepal, admittedly, not Southeast Asia.
Yeah, but still.
But maybe it was too late, so I don't regret it.
you don't. There was no thought about telling IVS that you changed your mind.
If there was a thought, it was fairly fleeting.
Mm-hmm.
But in hindsight, I had certainly a much more fascinating experience with both IVS and with Vietnam than I think I would have had with Peace Corps or Thailand. Although
I don't know about Thailand, but with Peace Corps,
I would have loved Thailand, and I think I would have done fine with Peace Corps too. But anyway,
yeah, but
everything
comparatively, I think you were
given what's
better
happened
off.
Since.
I
think I lucked out in terms of the opportunities that opened up for future career.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. What about your family's religion? Did that factor into it? Your own religious upbringing, or did you have a religious upbringing?
That's probably a reasonable question to ask because of the religious background of IBS.
Yeah, of many of the people.
And many of the people.
Yeah, even like your friend Carl, even though he wasn't...
Well, he more than most even, but...
Well, but he wasn't necessarily Mennonite or Brethren or Quaker, but still...
There was Methodist in his madness.
Yes, there was Methodist. Yes, and just a strong religious background. So did that factor in at all?
I'd grown up as Unitarian, which
mm-hmm.
Most people think of as nature worship, and many people do. And I remember in Vietnam when I would traipse around occasionally with French Canadian priests, they would just marvel at the idea of what this Unitarianism could be that didn't believe in a Trinity.
Yeah, I suppose that did kind of freak him.
It did. It really freaked this guy. And so I don't think the Unitarian piece came in that sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, it obviously had some impact on your creation as a being, but not necessarily the motivation to join.
It may have made me, I mean, at one level, it may have made me more open to other people's religions than if I'd grown up in a very doctrinaire faith. On the other hand, we had people, certainly in IVS and in Vietnam, who had grown up in more dogmatic, and I don't mean, I mean, with dogma.
Yes, yes.
Not in the stubborn sense, but,
yeah.
And they seem to have had a fine experience too, so I'm not sure whether that made any difference or not. I would guess it probably didn't.
We were talking last night about the psychological. It's really too hard to figure out.
Yes.
Because even someone growing up with heavy dogma in terms of religious belief may be growing up also with very liberal attitudes in other senses. And a curiosity of the world that cancels out the dogma and how it got built.
Right.
You know.
No, I think where some people may have had a kind of a missionary zeal for wanting to do this kind of service, in my case, I think it was more. I think it was more the Kennedy, I mean, that inaugural speech influence.
Because you actually heard
and the
speech.
Love of travel. I mean, I don't want to overemphasize the idealism factor in this, although there was some. I think a lot of it was just I was looking for adventure.
Okay, so you got adventure
and travel. Help somebody.
The Kennedy-esque.
Yeah, I don't want to put too much emphasis just on the Kennedy-esque.
No, but I'm just itemizing.
Yeah,
the call and the desire to help people.
So but I think I'd grown up with the desire to help people values in my. My father, I guess, to some extent. I'm just that ethos.
Yeah, I don't want to reduce any one individual's motivation to simply one individual factor.
Right. No, you couldn't.
Yeah. So I just wanted to be sure that I was clear on all the factors. You know. So in fact, our Kennedy kind of missionary stuff, in a secular sense, might have been there too, one of the factors in play.
Yes. If you not know? Due to Kennedy, at least. Maybe magnified a little bit by that.
Yeah, and given a focus, you know, which matched well with your own desires that were personal and idiosyncratic.
You said it better than I can. Yeah, that's right.
Oh.
No, no.
Scary.
No, I disagree with you if I didn't agree with it.
Okay. I'm always conscious that I have to be sure not to lead people.
Right.
Don't
worry, I won't let you.
Okay, all right. Well, you know, I mean, because a friend of mine listened to one tape. I was going, this was an anthropologist, I was going for advice on how to improve techniques, and said, you know, if that was a court of law, the opposing lawyer would say, objection, leading the witness.
You know? My guess is you'd find most IVS people are strong-willed enough that they would.
Yeah, they would. Yeah, if it was really wrong, you'd see it in their eyes, and they'd probably say,
or in their voice.
They'd say, not sure, you know. So, but I want to watch that. But anyway, one thing that I've found is fascinating is IVS training before you get over there. What did you have?
Not a lot.
That's what I find so fascinating. What did you have, anyway?
To tell you the truth, the only thing I really remember is the anthropologist who spoke to us at George Washington University.
Okay, so you were brought into D.C.
We had maybe a week, I can't remember exactly how long, in D.C. And which is where I was Carl Stockton's roommate.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I guess we had somebody talk about medical things, and then we had a couple of sessions, which were the highlight for me with the anthropologist. Well, I'd always been interested in anthropology at college anyway. And
well, what was your major?
My major was comparative literature.
Okay. All right. But anthropology would work in that.
Well, when I did my senior thesis, it was I sort of worked it in, but no, it was really a equally as a separate interest. But
I could see that there could be useful.
And it, in fact, it turned out to ended up being a much greater interest in terms of what I later did or learned in Vietnam. But
You couldn't tell me what else.
What else has an orientation? But I find that even now with my students, when they go on 15-week programs and you interview them at the end of the program, they can't tell you what happened in their orientation 15 weeks before. So I don't feel too bad if I can't tell you 33
years. Don't feel too bad. Don't feel bad. It's just I've been struck at how quickly people were.
Well, now, of course, when we got to Vietnam.
All right.
We had, it was almost all language at that point, which was terribly important.
Yeah.
In hindsight, I think the language could have been done a lot better by putting us in smaller groups.
Mm-hmm.
There were 15 of us or something in one class, or maybe even more, 15 or 20. And nowadays, I mean, this is the business I'm in now. We do language training for our students, and the much faster way to learn a difficult language in particular is to put them in groups of 3 to 5 or at least no more than 7 or 8.
Yeah, that's what I had.
Yeah, and in fact, now in my current job, we use Peace Corps teachers a lot, too.
Oh, do you?
So, but it wasn't, I'm never sure how much orientation you can really give up front either. So, but what we didn't have very much of was culture, training, history.
Mm-hmm.
We had virtually none of that. And I think that was a real lack. And some of us would do it on our own, but probably very little and probably very few of us really did it. So my guess is Peace Corps did that at the time a lot better than IVS did.
I can't speak about your time of training. What year was 63 for the beginning? Because when did you arrive in Vietnam?
July 63.
Okay. So the application process was in 62, maybe, and then by the time you get everything squared away at some time during 63?
Probably I didn't even apply till early
63. Oh, okay.
I can't remember now.
So that went fairly
quick. Or Christmas time, I don't know.
Yeah. Either very late 62
or early. Yeah, IVS was very quick.
Okay. And I'm not sure what Peace Corps was doing in 63, if they had already gotten materials for folks and put them through a lot of history and culture.
Well, by Peace Corps training, I think, was 3 months long.
Yeah. And I'm not sure what they did
ours
during
was that week in Washington or whatever it was, and then 1 month in Vietnam for language.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few of us asked for a more advanced Vietnamese course about a year or two later. And I think that should have been an option, more regular intervals and earlier. I mean, that goes beyond the purpose of your study, probably.
But I think you're right.
There was not. There needs to be a lot more attention to this whole area.
Yeah, there does. Yeah.
Peace Corps now does it very well because when I visit my own programs, I periodically meet the Peace Corps people and find out how they're doing it. They generally do, I think, a very good job.
Yeah.
Nowadays,
at least, yeah. We had. Well, I don't milk land my own training, but I was, at least the history and culture stuff that we had, this does have some relevance, at least was packaged and focused, as opposed to just a couple lectures and then just on your way, and, although by the time you're in IVS, it's a lot better than some of the people who were in, let's say, 57, 58, where they were given 3 or 4 days in Washington, sent on a plane, and no language.
Well, that's roughly what we had. I mean, maybe it was 5 or 6 days in
Washington. But no language even when they got there.
When they got there?
Yeah. Well, I spoke to somebody who went to Laos in 57. It was just like, well, pick it up. We'll give you an interpreter.
That's an exception, because I know Don went in 57, I think, wasn't it?
Mm. I'm not sure.
He certainly had language.
Mm.
Okay. Well, anyway.
Tell me your first impressions when you arrived.
Hot, humid, dazed. We had a barbecue or lunch or something at the IVS House Terrace, then went to have our pictures taken for identification cards at the USAID office, or USAM, I guess it was whatever it was called then. And then were the same afternoon whisked down to Mitaw for our language training. And I don't really, I mean, I was open-eyed and tired and excited and tired. And, and we were all jammed into a couple of very small rooms for sleeping quarters and had our language training in the same place. And our major diet item was bananas, which is one of the first words, or probably the first word we learned in Vietnamese. And then gradually, or not even gradually, we quickly became a source of great entertainment to all the kids in the neighborhood. And it was a very charming town.
What town was it?
Mitaw.
Mitaw, okay.
Actually, I tried going back there last fall when I was in Saigon and had an extra day. And it didn't work out. But anyway, the town was very charming, and I think we really had a nice time there.
That was
work doing the language, and obviously people proceeded at very different speeds, which is one thing that was kind of frustrating probably for everybody. Some were chomping at the bit, and others were straining to keep up.
Yeah, and if you had a large class, you couldn't break them down into different groups with some that need more specialized help. And
I mean, where we got our specialized help, if that's what you want to call it, is practicing with the cook and the houseboy and with the kids who gathered around.
Yeah.
Which was important, actually. Which and it was, that
no,
was
it
fun.
Is. They take you on field trips to the marketplace to teach you how to bargain and
no,
such?
They didn't do any of that. See, that's the thing, that it was too big a group and there was only one teacher. And,
Yeah.
We didn't do any of that field stuff. It was all sitting in the room.
Yeah, that's too bad. I mean, you would have done it later anyway. But
well, we had to on our own.
Yeah. But it would have been nice to get dipped in that way.
Yeah.
With the
I probably didn't find it quite as frustrating as others because I started using my French when I when we got hooked up very early on, which was terrific, was a Vietnamese student group. And in fact, somewhere along the line, some of us got transferred from the English teaching team to the Hamlet School Program team. And which was, we were going to be responsible for helping to get Hamlet School started in the, we didn't then realize how ideologically tainted strategic Hamlet program, or politically tainted. That's where your other subject starts coming in very quickly.
I was actually going to ask you.
But those of us who got into that just on
what
that,
the Hamlet school program was. It was linked up with the strategic Hamlet program.
President Diem's brother had created the Strategic Hamlet Program in 1962, the year before, and the big spiked fences or double fences and barbed wire around every hamlet, and people were forcibly put into them. I mean, some of them may have wanted to, but again, we had no orientation of that sort that would have given us any of the background of that. So we were led to believe that these were great ideas to protect people from the nasty communists. And at one level, I suppose that was the case. And we were helping in what was to be my assignment in the Highlands, was in mostly a tribal area. And at least with respect to the tribals, the Montagnard, they had no experience really with what schools were, even for the most part. So it was considered this wonderful thing that we were bringing the light of education into these dark communities. And again, there's something to that. So anyway, the reason I bring it up this context is because those of us who were going in that essentially kind of community development focus program were hooked up with Vietnamese student group to go on a work camp 1 month into or 3 weeks into our stay there. And that was a time when I was really feeling an advantage because I could communicate with the students, most of whom knew French reasonably well, when the others, a few of them knew English, but in those days very few people knew much English.
So how much of an advantage beyond this first experience was knowing French?
It was a big advantage. For the first 6 months to a year, I basically worked in French. And while, although I still, I think, you could argue it may have held back my Vietnamese a little bit, I think I really worked on the Vietnamese too. So mm-hmm. Within a year, I think I was mostly using Vietnamese. Yeah, depended. With people who knew French, I probably was still, for my work, I was probably using French more, but then I'd go back and forth. And
did that get you a higher respect?
Yes. Yeah, I think I was at an advantage.
With any particular people or with everyone?
French-educated people, certainly. Mm-hmm. Others, I don't know. Probably, because I was in education, and educated Vietnamese were to know French. And you'd probably have to ask those who didn't whether they felt it would have made a difference, but I felt that it did.
In a very positive way.
I think so. I don't want to overestimate it, but it certainly made me feel that I was getting a lot more out of my experience because I could really talk with people about anything.
Yeah. No, actually.
And even the Montagnard, many of them knew French who didn't know Vietnamese or were just learning Vietnamese.
Okay.
Like me.
Uh-huh.
And it was more neutral because the Montagnard tended to be anti-Vietnamese, reciprocating the other mm-hmm. direction of feeling.
Yeah.
And so to be able to communicate with somebody in French was neutralized that element of it. So yes, I was very lucky that I knew French.
Yeah. No, the use of French came up in another interview that I had with somebody.
I think I was surprised how few IBSers did have French.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what this person said. He wished he had had some French.
Yeah.
And I think, I may be wrong, but I think he mentioned you. I think it might have been Carl, who noted how you knew French and how that was something of an advantage, although he couldn't say how much for you, because at least among the educated folk, he felt at a disadvantage not knowing French to prove his academic credentials.
Yes, I could guess that would have been that.
You know, whereas you didn't have that problem because you obviously knew French, so you must be an educated person.
Yeah, I'm not trying.
You know, well, at least in the perception.
Yeah.
That others might have had of you.
Well, interestingly, Don Luce just forwarded to me a couple of months ago a letter from a former secretary in the IBS office from that period.
Uh-huh.
And she had noticed, he had written to her apparently on the IBS letterhead, which still had my name as a board member on there.
Are you a board member now?
No.
Oh, okay.
I rotated off. But she said, is that the John Summer, among other things, who knew French? So obviously...
No, really?
So it was unusual, and it obviously...
Yeah. Yeah, and it made a very...
And she knew English.
...deep impression, too.
Apparently it did, yeah.
Wow. And so your knowledge of French was really, the difference between saber and connaisseur. It was really, I know French, and so that they probably picked up on it, that you knew it very well.
Yeah, I frankly hadn't thought to emphasize that aspect of as much as just the fact that I could really communicate with a lot more people.
Well, I may be drawing it out, but but I find it interesting. I personally just find it interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm also taking advantage of the tape time to talk to you just and learn stuff for myself, you know, because I can always just zip over this real quick.
It could have worked the other way, of course, if people had had a really anti-colonial feeling, but that's not been my experience in former colonies. Mostly, whatever they think about the colonial period, they've absorbed enough of the snobism, maybe it is, and part of just...
There is a kind of love-hate relationship.
Yeah, yeah, and I was picking the love, not the hate.
Yes,
picking up on that, so that was lucky too.
Yeah, yeah, and it's another psychological thing that's mm-hmm. it's really interesting. It's mm-hmm. really, I mean, again, this should maybe be off tape, but there's the same sort of relationship between Filipinos and Americans.
Oh, I think it's sickening how much the Filipinos loved Americans, at least when I was there.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It is. I mean, it
more
really...
than I do.
I mean, they refer to it as colonial mentality and, you know, all of that, but even some of those who are most opposed to the colonial mentality rush to come to the States for a conference or something.
Right.
You know?
No, love-hate, I think. Really,
yeah, it really is. It's amazing. So anyway, you started to get into the work in the Hamlet program, and I think I had made I don't know if I made a note here. No, I didn't. But I was interested in this job of the Hamlet School program and what all that was. Could you describe that a little bit?
Actually, the particular two provinces where I was assigned, I was delayed in going to my main assignment.
Which was where?
Which was in Lamdong province, because the IVS jeep had been shot at just before I was to go there, so they decided to let things settle a bit.
Good idea.
Sent me up somewhere else for a month, bound me to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I could study some, and then I was intended to study Vietnamese during that time, and in fact did. Along with reading Anna Karenina, I think. But
that would take a month.
The job was basically to I started to say in those two provinces the Hamlet School program was actually being financed by Asia Foundation and through Asia Foundation.
Not AID.
Well, AID was trying. It was all the same U.S. government money.
Mm-hmm.
But AID was trying to diversify the appearance of not having. It seemed as though it was the only one who was doing everything. So
okay.
That was a particular province that got channeled through Asia Foundation,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is just probably neither here nor there in this case. But I did have mm-hmm. some association with their staff people in
mm-hmm.
In Saigon, which was nice. That was
mm-hmm.
Interesting. But
were they very different from the USAID folks?
As people, yeah, I would say so.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, obviously not part of the same bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it wasn't part of a bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a lot to do with them. I mean, we were
yeah.
incredibly left alone.
Oh, no, no, I realize that, but I'm just interested in this other funding source, even if it was only a conduit.
I think it was only a conduit. Of course, we later learned where the origin. Anyway, the main part of the job was to make sure that the schools for which there were funds available were put in places that they should be put, as opposed to where some district chief or other might have wanted to give a benefit to some purpose.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
Secondly, to make sure that to assist with the training of the teachers and to make efforts to see that the training was relevant to the kinds of needs that the students in those villages would have.
Mm-hmm.
And then third, to basically support the teachers as they were beginning their work. Many of them were newly trained, most of them had never been trained as teachers at all.
Oh, okay. Just college educated, but no education courses.
Oh, good heavens, not college educated.
Not even college educated.
In
okay.
Montagnard, you were lucky to get somebody.
Oh, they're Montagnard, for the first assignment.
I was
yes,
dealing
yes.
with both Montagnards and ethnic Vietnamese.
Uh-huh, okay.
But even the Vietnamese, if mm-hmm. they had an elementary school education, we were quite lucky.
Ah, okay.
Oh, this was... So, and as I said, many of the Montagnard had no idea what even schools were.
Yeah,
so
right.
I have a poster somewhere that I developed to show what a school was in Montagnard in the local Montagnard language.
Right.
So it was absolutely fascinating. And I just articulated three objectives of this program, which I'm not sure that anyone articulated to me at the beginning. I don't remember really having any training in this either, except that here were these monies that were going to be made available to these departments of education.
Mm-hmm.
And just help them get these schools going. I think, as I recall, that was about the level of detail of my instructions.
Yeah.
So I basically, I think we all just did what we could to see what we could do.
Just
and then I taught English on the side in the evenings and on weekends.
I think a lot
so
of people
forth.
Did that.
That was just to me.
Even
people,
in CD or RD,
oh, yeah.
whatever they call
yeah.
it, you
yeah,
know, and AG did that too.
In fact, I was living with an AG member of the team in mm-hmm. Dalat my first year.
Mm-hmm. Who was that?
Dan Leedy.
Dale Leedy?
Dan.
Dan.
Leedy.
Hmm. Can't remember if we heard back from him.
I don't know where he is now. He later joined AID for many years.
Uh-huh.
And, I inherited one of my classes from him when he left, for example.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, what about working with the local political powers that be in the placement of these schools. You mentioned that was one of the things that you had to do. That would have been a kind of a bear. A very difficult thing to do, I would suspect. How did you negotiate this?
One particular district, I mean, I was just this young twerp. I was 22 or was like 20. Yeah, I guess by then
shouldn't
I
shouldn't call yourself a twerp.
Well, I kept wondering why Vietnamese kept saying, you're so young.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think of myself as so young, but of course, when I think back on it now, they were absolutely right. And here I was dealing with people who were not necessarily much older, but certainly in their 30s or 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one district chief in particular had a very set idea of where he was going to put these schools and who the contractor was going to be.
Uh-huh.
And it became clear very quickly what proportions the contractor used to mix his cement and his water and his sand and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I got myself right into the middle of that, and I probably should have been much more scared, but with the naivete of youth.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I had a couple of confrontations about it, fortunately.
Really?
With other people there.
Uh-huh.
For the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I wasn't in a position to turn on or off the through the Asia Foundation or through AID, I guess, which was actually supplying the cement. I wasn't in a position to turn off the cement in the resource supply.
So you did have a little bit of clout, even though you were this young, quote-unquote, twerp.
Yeah, well, otherwise they wouldn't have had any reason to listen to me.
Yeah.
So, and the aid guy had been a former IVSer,
mm-hmm.
also, although I think he would have been reasonable enough anyway.
Mm-hmm. Who was he?
Don Wadley.
Okay.
So that was, and then the selection of sites. I mean, another district director wanted to put schools in places that already had schools. And in some cases, you could argue that an expansion was desirable, but the point of the program was really to get to these new hamlets, which
mm-hmm.
didn't have anything,
mm-hmm.
to give the people some reason for wanting to stay there. Again, this was the political piece of it fit in, but also the educational desirability.
Yeah.
So I can't even remember now really how I did it. I think I said, wouldn't it be better to, for the purpose of the program, to have it in these places that have nothing? And one region, in one district, there were some schools that had been built by the local people themselves of very primitive materials.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, my gosh, we ought to reward their self-help initiative and give them the permanent concrete buildings.
Uh-huh. How did that go over?
Well, since I did have the clout, and maybe they couldn't argue that point. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
They did it.
They did it. Okay. That's good.
Again, I think in retrospect they would have had to, because I'm not sure whether they would have gotten the cement for something else. But we probably worked out some schools did get built onto in other areas. And
make little compromises. And
yeah, I didn't think of them at the time as being compromises, but maybe they took them as face savers or something.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I don't think we put schools in places where they really shouldn't have been put at all.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But there were some of each kind, so.
So, yeah.
And then the training of the Vietnamese, the ethnic Vietnamese, looked down very much on the Montagnard, as you know.
Yeah.
And the fact that an American was interested in the savages, which was a term they were still using, the Vietnamese version of that term, to some extent that term was beginning to be outlawed in effect, but
mm-hmm.
I think probably raised some people's views that maybe they ought to take these people a little bit seriously after all. And if nothing else, I was watching to make sure that the supplies went to the Montagnard. So, and I was very lucky with my counterpart, particularly in the one province, who was, and she's the one person I'm still in touch with from those days. She's retired and 70 years old now.
Is she the person you mentioned in the Rawlings book?
Miss Du?
I think you did. Yeah.
Yeah. She had a really good attitude.
Mm-hmm.
She's one of the very few officials mm-hmm. who had a really good attitude about trying to do something for people who really needed it.
I think that's rare anywhere.
It was wrong. It was rare in this setting. And in the other place, in the other province, the directors of education and so forth went along with it, and they thought it was kind of quaint that this American should have such interest in these savages. But so they went along with it, so the same purpose got accomplished.
Right.
But she really felt it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. She sounds very nice. It really does. The old maid school teacher who never married, huh?
Yes, that was another little. Of course, people started spreading rumors then.
Oh, about you and her? Uh-oh. that's a tough thing to.
And somebody wrote a terrible, nasty article about it, which got published.
Oh no.
And those were among the letters I just came across the other day again.
Uh-huh.
To the extent that people thought I had written it, because it was written as if I had written it. But anyway, that's the whole diversion again.
Well, no. It is maybe, but that what you just said contradicts what I thought you said earlier. You mean, I know about the rumors. This thing that was written that got published, it was as if you wrote it?
Yeah. It was in my voice writing about this old maid.
Uh-huh.
And how to deal with her love for me or something. And it, in a kind of a, well, it's really a diversion, but it was,
yeah, but that's a,
I it got straightened out pretty quickly, and I, to this day, I don't even know if she ever knew about it. She was out of the country at the particular time. It was after I'd left a lot.
That's good that she was out of the country.
But I don't. She may have heard about it. I just don't know.
Gosh. No, I know that we in Peace Corps always had to worry about those things. I mean, I being in agriculture didn't have that as much. But anyone in education had to really watch themselves. Because there's all sorts of rumors that could come back and really hurt people. And not necessarily the volunteer, it was in and out.
Yeah, no, it didn't hurt me. It was,
yeah,
it
was, would hurt her.
It was going to hurt me. Her.
Yeah, very, very definitely. So I just saw that as a parallel. That I knew that not myself, but other people had to worry about constantly. And some people went out of their way to be proper with single women, school teachers, you know.
Well, she's quite a bit older, too. So.
Yeah, but even so. I mean, much more than you normally would have been proper. You know, I'd be absolutely sure you were never in a room alone or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You know, no compromising circumstance at all. Anyway, when did we... I'm sorry. Moving right along, quickly. Tiptoeing through it. Obviously, the program was political. It had this political edge. You mentioned it. You know, when did the political use of the school Hamlet school program really? When did you really begin to figure it out?
That's the right question. I'm not sure that. I certainly knew that it was political in the sense that it was helping to make people's lives better in these villages in which they were being collected to help them resist the nasty communists who we were hearing all the time were doing bloody-minded things.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we were all part, it's hard to reconstruct with the mindset of those days, but I mean, we were all anti-communist.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that would sound most quaint now. It does sound most quaint now. So I don't think that I was particularly at the time being aware that it was political in a sense that it was nasty politics. It was helping these poor people who were under this terrible threat. And I don't think that any of us, be interesting what you hear from other people on this, I don't think, and this is a major theme, I'm sure, question. I don't think any of us really became politicized, per se, until about 1966.
Why that year?
I think in 1965 was when the American troops started coming in, in the spring of 65.
Mm-hmm. March, actually.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, yes, I remember because I had just moved to Hue at that point to become team leader in the First Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten to know General T, partly because of my French, and actually became somewhat close to him.
Really?
Later on. Oh. Yeah. And I remember being at a reception at his official delegate's house on the banks of the Perfume River the night that we had heard that the Marines had come ashore.
In Da Nang.
Mm-hmm. And I said to General T, "You must be happy to have this U.S. military direct support now," and he was just beaming. So anyway, that's
he was beaming.
So I would have said March or April. I couldn't remember, but and then I think we just started seeing the excesses of what was going on. Because it's late in late 65, Peter Hundy was killed. He was part of our group.
Yeah.
63.
Oh, he was part of your group.
And coincidentally, okay. He'd been a classmate of mine at college.
I
didn't know him well at all.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know each other well at all. But we were kind of a little special group because he was one of the Hamlet School people as well.
Okay.
And lived fairly nearby. We visit each other occasionally.
How did he die?
He drove into an ambush.
Okay. I heard from someone else that he was driving along and his Jeep hit a landmine and blew up. So it wasn't as accidental as that. It was a specific targeted ambush.
No,
not
we
random
don't think
violence.
It was targeted. He was...
It wasn't targeted specifically.
Apparently, he had passed a military convoy driving in the Delta somewhere.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And the supposition was that they were waiting for the convoy, and here was this clearly foreign aid vehicle, which I later inherited because I took over his duties in addition to the other ones I had after that. And they saw his vehicle, and maybe they took even the time to see there was the American in there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we don't think it was planned specifically against him personally.
Okay.
But anyway, at that point, he was killed by the VC.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I haven't used that term VC in years, but I'll go into my mode at the time at this point.
Sure.
And we were outraged. I mean, just another reason to be doing what we were doing to defeat the wicked VC.
Right.
So it wasn't until early 66, but the accumulation of terrible things and the escalation generally.
Mm-hmm.
In March of 65, just to... Pardon my going back and forth here. Don asked me to stay on for another, I guess at that point we were talking a year, maybe it was two, but we agreed 1 year, and promoted me to team leader.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just after the Gulf of Tonkin. And a major motivation for me to stay on was because, you know, here we now we're finally going to get an end to this war, and I wanted to be there when the war ended.
Mm-hmm.
So, I wasn't the only one who was that stupid. As it turned out. That's also the last time I ever made a political prediction, by the way. But so by 66, in short, we were seeing the excesses. I also, in my case, went back to start a graduate degree in the fall of 66. Or actually, I left in the late spring.
So you stayed...
My term was interrupted when it says 63 to 2nd. I went the 7. I went back from April to...
April.
I was out of Vietnam for a calendar year.
So,
and then I came back with a summer group for 4 months.
Let me get the chronology straight. Arriving in country in 63,
July. Left April 66.
April of 66. So you did that third year, which ended in April of 66.
Yes, and then on my way home, I took a 6 week or 2 month tour of various countries through Europe and so forth for mm-hmm. USIA, speaking about the IBS experiences in Vietnam.
Oh, okay.
That was an eye opener. So that's coming to what I was starting to.
Okay. Yeah.
I hope you're going to be able to put
I'll put this together. But that's why I'm asking for the recap of the chronology.
Then I started being put in touch with Europeans who were critical of what the U.S. was doing there.
Mm-hmm. And had to answer questions.
And then when I got back to the States, of course, and the anti-war movement was going on
mm-hmm.
by 66, mid-66.
Still embryonic, but growing strong.
And then I started being out of the country and not being confronted with only one side of the picture, but hearing several sides.
Mm-hmm.
My own mind started being reinforced in probably even starting to think in other ways. I mean, I was seeing all the bad things that were going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then seeing those through a different set of lenses, more objective. Well, the combination was more objective.
Okay.
I had a lot of trouble with the anti-war movement people because they didn't know what they were talking about, really.
Mm-hmm.
But they had some correct instincts, and they had a different paradigm, which forced me to see it in a different way. So anyway, by the time I went back then again in May 67, or early June, whenever it was, I was pretty active in the anti-war movement side of it. So, and I think that happened to many of us, even the ones who didn't come home in between Well, you'd have to ask them. I'm not sure. But 66 was basically the latter part of 65, very end of 65, mm-hmm. but really more 66 was the politicization of, I think, of the IBS people. But the education people first, I think.
Why?
I don't know. That's an interesting question you should, or maybe you are asking.
I am.
Ask them, the non-education people. Yeah. My answer to that, I think the education team people tended to be of an educational background which was more politically, either more politicized in the first place or more politically inclined.
Okay.
And I think the agriculture people had been more of a, had more of a specialization,
mm-hmm.
perhaps, in their particular fields, and didn't think, and at least at the beginning, probably weren't as quick
mm-hmm.
to get interested even in the mm-hmm. this kind of effete politics or whatever. This is my guess, and I don't mean it that they were any dumber or anything else.
No, not at all.
I think it was just a matter of the training and the set of interests. And this certainly be in, after my time, I think the people who came in 66, 67, 68, I mean, then I think a lot of people did come because they were curious from a political point of view.
So they brought their political...
I got converted. I think many of them who came later were converted before they came. My conversion happened there.
Yeah.
Well, there and then back
Here. There and the experience of what you've just described. Yeah, could it be that the agriculture community development folks, because maybe they were more focused in their job activities.
Well, I think I was focused in my job activity.
Well, I didn't mean, I used the word focus wrong.
I think they were focused with people who were doing agriculture, and probably we were focused more with people who were in education, and therefore were talking about, I don't know, maybe the... See, I got fairly close to some of these Vietnamese student leaders.
Yeah,
particularly very close, in fact, in Hue.
Okay.
And they were very anti-Saigon government and very anti-U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talk about living with NPA people. I was really working, mm-hmm. more than waving at that point, I was working on a daily basis with anti-Americans.
Yeah.
Anti-American policies.
Right. People. Not personal. They accepted you.
With difficulty.
They had to check you out.
That job was a very sensitive job. Mm-hmm. And that's another major piece of probably my politicization in that period.
How
during
come?
65 and into 66.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was dealing with political students.
Mm-hmm.
And in retrospect, I was sort of aware of it at the time, mm-hmm. but it seemed like a good thing. The reason that the U.S. was financing the student social welfare projects, which is what I was working with them on,
mm-hmm.
was to keep them off the streets and from demonstrating against the Saigon government.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, this was always, you know, sort of a second order of magnitude of why this was a good thing to do. And if I'd been really politicized at the beginning, I would have realized that as a more central thing, and maybe then I would have felt more loath to abet that particular cause. On mm-hmm. the other hand, I myself was still feeling that the communists were not a great alternative,
uh-huh.
and that anything else would only help the communists, which in fact is exactly the truth.
Yeah.
Anyway, to cut a long story short, I ended up being influenced by the
this is really interesting. You know, I got politicized by students at the University of the Philippines after my Peace Corps stuff. And
well, we do get influenced by the people we hang around with, of course.
Well, yeah. So I just find this an interesting sort of parallel. I can sort of understand how you would have. But did you really learned a great deal from them? Do you think? Because you described your own awakening as when you left and you were on the world tour.
Well, I was always interested in international politics. In fact, I probably should have been, instead of comparative literature, I probably should have majored in social sciences.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but it certainly was an influence. I don't... whether it awakened, I don't know. It aroused, certainly.
Okay.
And they were... we had some fascinating conversations. A lot of that is in the Vietnam book,
mm-hmm.
and her voices. But they were all members, of course, of this so-called third force, the Buddhist, mm-hmm. which General T was the military counterpart of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where I was. I mean, I was anti-communist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still anti-communist.
Mm-hmm.
I was increasingly horrified by what the South Vietnamese government was doing or was not doing, and increasingly with what the U.S. was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the Third Force, therefore, was the only place that I had to go to.
Yeah.
Even though I knew and... Well, I didn't... It was a naive thought to think that there was room for a Third Force, in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in late 65, I think November, Henry Kissinger, who was at that time a Harvard professor,
mm-hmm.
came, and I was asked to be his interpreter at a meeting with the Hue intelligentsia, mm-hmm. at the consul's house. And as it turned out, he knew French, so he didn't really need the interpretation. But it was that evening was interesting. First of all, the rector, I remember, and others of the leading—I mean, these were all the leaders of the Buddhist struggle movement, the Third Force. They were all concerned when they heard he was coming because all they knew about was his writings on nuclear power.
Yeah.
So they put two and two together and surmised that.
Came up with five. Yeah.
But then I remember Kissinger himself saying he was fascinated to these people. Actually, he came up to me at the end of the dinner when the Vietnamese had left and said he was particularly struck by the person that I was so earnestly engaged in conversation was. He could see how bright he was. Actually, he was the intellectual leader behind the group.
Uh-huh.
So we were chatting a bit about what this guy was saying and what he had heard. As a postscript to that, Kissinger, when I later saw him when he was in government, when he was Nixon's aide, he discounted that whole evening. And that's another story. But anyway...
He discounted the whole evening?
Well, I said to him, you seem so sympathetic at the time to what these guys were saying.
Yeah, yeah.
So he said, but the rector said, I don't give a damn about villagers. And with that, he basically discounted everything that he'd heard that evening. Although I have a letter from him, uh-huh. even now, saying, thank you so much. I think I learned more from you and the German psychiatrist he'd met on that trip uh-huh. than from anybody else about Vietnam. I have very mixed feelings about that letter. But
yeah, see what you taught him?
It'll probably be worth something
someday. So you're responsible for Kissinger.
Don and I went together to see Kissinger.
Okay, no. Don bears partial responsibility, and this German shrink.
Anyway, how do we get onto that?
The Third Force.
The Third Force.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
basically, he said...
Because the intellectual leader that you were talking to is basically the spokesperson for this Hue group of intelligentsia
yeah.
who were actively trying to seek some alternative
yeah.
between the two sides.
Kissinger was right in the sense that there was no room for a Third Force because then mm-hmm. the communist force was the strongest and would have wiped him out. And in fact did.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. A Third Force without guns.
And in fact, coincidentally, when I was back, just to finish your sequence, I was back in a totally different 3-week capacity with the Ford Foundation in 1974. That was the last time I was in Vietnam before mm-hmm. the changeover.
Mm-hmm.
And I met the rector, that same rector from Hue. He was then in Saigon, basically, and wasn't mm-hmm. quite house arrest, but he was,
mm-hmm.
I don't think he was doing anything at the time.
Yeah.
And he said that we had this conversation about the evening with Kissinger. And... he said, too, he thought he was sympathetic. He just didn't know what had happened after that, why he'd done all these awful things since then. So, and he was really worried. Here was the leader of the Third Force, and he was saying, he's the only person who said it to me in this Hue on that trip. He said, the VC are at the gates of Saigon. Basically, the...
In 74, he said that.
This was August
before the offensive. So
before they took over, well, before the offensive in February. We started
mm-hmm,
in February.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that was the only... Again, I didn't pay it any special heed at that point because no one else was. People were very worried at that point, of course, of what, even though it seemed very calm.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But he was the only one who had the overt premonition that the beginning of the end was in sight for them.
Yeah, it was very immediately in sight. Yeah, not just a 3-4 yeah. years down the road.
So anyway, the upshot is I was very wrapped up in that whole group, and it was actually a fascinating mm-hmm. experience, and I feel privileged to have been trusted to an extraordinary extent by them.
Why do you think you were? What do you think it was about you that gained their trust?
That's a good question.
I hope I'm asking good ones.
Maybe because I seem so young and naive.
That's it.
With damage. No, but they were very suspicious.
Bring them in young and stupid, yeah.
They were very suspicious.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they felt that I was sympathetic to them. They used me as a channel to the consulate people.
Oh, really? Okay.
And I felt I had very mixed feelings about being in that role. I think, mm-hmm. although, and this is again probably a major point, I think I'm not the only one who was in that position of ending up being an interpreter of what Vietnamese were thinking to official Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But I would sometimes, I remember one time in particular, I had a very compelling discussion with the guy who people think led the burning of the U.S. library in Hue the year before. And he was saying some pretty blunt things. It took me quite a while to get in with him
mm-hmm.
to where I thought he trusted me. And I said, you know, the U.S. officials really ought to be hearing this point of view, because it really was sounding compelling to me, and I didn't think that the U.S. was officialdom was appreciating even hearing these points of view.
Probably not.
And he said, well, why did you tell him?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, do you really want me to? I said, I will if you want me to, but otherwise, I don't think I'd be inclined to.
Mm-hmm.
So he basically asked me to. So I did, and at that point, I slipped into the role of, I guess.
Yeah.
And then it got to the point where I expressed curiosity once, I think, in seeing the cable that was written about my report. And they said I couldn't see it because it was classified.
What you yourself had written.
Yeah, I thought that was funny. No, I didn't write anything. What I told them, the conversation when I told the consular person about what this guy had asked me to pass on.
Yes, yes. And then you wanted to see what Saigon was telling Washington.
Well, what Hue was telling Saigon. At that
point. Excuse me, what Hue was telling Saigon, which may or may not have been passed on to Washington.
Yeah.
It might be now released.
Yes, that's an interesting idea. I suppose I could ask under Freedom of Information. You or might, even without it.
Without it, because I've looked, well, let's see, what year was it?
65.
Not quite yet, but it might be soon it's in the National years. Archives on microfilm.
How soon do you think it would be?
It takes 30 years, but a couple years to do all of the bullshit and to do the microfilm.
Oh, so 30 years is the official...
Yeah, for at least the initial stuff.
Well, maybe someday in my retirement I'll do that.
Yeah.
I would be curious.
Yeah, it's in the microfilm reading room of the National Archives on the Mall in D.C.
Hmm.
Yeah. And you got to deal with all those people who are doing their genealogies, you know, looking up great-grandfather Jehoshaphat, who got, you know, his purple heart by getting some buckshot at, you know, in his rear end at the, you know, the Battle of, you know... Bent River or something. You know?
Yeah, I'm now curious myself about this question of why did they talk. I think that they wanted people to understand their view.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt that I was a more sympathetic listener, I guess, than somebody.